From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food. It's Christmas Eve, and we're baking cookies. What pair of chefs have in common with fashion designers? A New Year's dish that promises luck and prosperity. The best type of chestnut for roasting over the open fire. Plus, are you staying in or going out this New Year's Eve? I've got the inside scoop on how to make this New Year's Eve a memorable affair. But first, let's see what's fresh and in season this very busy week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It's Christmas Eve, and we're on the brink of the wonderful week of food and fun and sharing the great bounty of the farmers market. Josiah Citrin is here, and he has written a absolutely gorgeous new cookbook, The Pursuit of Excellence. And Josiah, it is an absolutely delicious looking cookbook. Tell us a little bit about how it came to be and what some of the recipes are and where we can get this book.
Okay, well, it's just one of those things. I wanted to write a book, and a lot of people requested it, and I just wanted to kind of put the philosophy on food, like where I get my produce, everything that kind of makes me go and wants me to do food and what, you know, makes me tick. One of the signs I have in the kitchen is In Pursuit of Excellence, and that's kind of where it all, the name, the title came, you know, that we're always striving for excellence every day to be, you know, the best we can be.
Well, your restaurant is known for being the quintessential fine dining French restaurant, and you have the two Michelin stars, and it is an absolute sort of otherworldly experience going into your restaurant, seeing the perfection that is everywhere. And you were telling me that I could do those, just I could get your book and I could actually do that at home.
Yeah, I mean, it's, we really went through, I mean, it takes time. And just like it takes us time in the restaurant, nothing's really whipped together food, and that's what makes it great. But it's not only that you can make the whole dish. If you like a sauce, you can make a sauce. I have one of my friends and longtime customers who bought a book, and he made the halibut. He saw some halibut at the fish market, and he wanted to make the halibut with a smoked bacon and fava bean sauce. But it wasn't fava beans. He got some edamame, and he just made the halibut and the sauce. He didn't make all the other garnishes that went with it. So it's okay just to pick and choose from things. I hope that everybody takes this book and just cooks out of it one piece of a dish. It doesn't have to be the whole thing. One component, another component.
Okay, well, thank you so much. The book is an absolute reflection of the excellence that is Malise. That's been, you've been in business how many years?
12 and a half years.
12 and a half years at Malise. That seems like only yesterday. Well, thanks so much, Josiah. And the book is absolutely gorgeous. And so glad you're part of the market. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Josiah Citrin. His book is out. It's called The Pursuit of Excellence. It's got gorgeous photos and recipes from the fabulous kitchen of Malise. So great holiday present, and it's not too late to pick one up today. We're talking with Nate Siemens, who is one of the purveyors here at Fat Uncle Farm. Not one person in the booth, however, is fat. And I doubt if your uncle is even fat, but here we are. And you are the ones that have these wonderful almond products. You've got these blistered almonds. You've got almond paste, almond meal, almond butter. And today we happen to notice you have jars of pickled green almonds. Tell us about how you make those and how people eat them, what they eat them with.
Absolutely. You eat these with your hands. They're really handy that way. The pickled green almonds, we harvest them in April and May when the almonds are still immature, just after they start to grow on the trees, about 2 months after the bloom and pollination. So they're these cute, fuzzy little almonds, and we pick them off the tree, and we just dump them in a brine, the same as you would any type of pickle. This particular batch we made with some lemons and some fresh herbs, both from our farm, and some garlic too. And they're really fun. They look different than anything you'd probably see at the farmer's market. They look kind of like a fuzzy olive, and that's kind of what they taste like, is a fuzzy pickle or olive, and they can be used the same way too.
So what we see in the jar looks like a giant, like you said, olive, but really it's mostly husk and then inner lining, and the actual almond itself is just a little kind of gelatinous thing right in the very center.
Yeah, that's right. The gelatinous part is the undeveloped almond seed. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like a pickle. The cucumber, the seeds haven't developed yet. There aren't hard seeds inside a pickle. Mm-hmm. They're jello inside, and that's the same thing with the almond. It's a little bit different. It's a little funny, but I like them.
Do people like slice them up, or you just eat it, like munch it like a, you know, like a, like an almond, or?
You know, I've been kind of interviewing people on that, and I think it takes all types. There's no particular way that I know of other than just, you know, pop them in your mouth. I think they would slice fine though too.
And are you mostly tasting brine? Is there any almond flavor yet?
Yeah, this particular preparation, you're just tasting the brine. The same with the pickle.
Well, this is really great. And so you have a supply. When they're gone, obviously, and then we have to wait till next year till you can pickle some more. Yeah. So in the meantime, we can enjoy everything else you have out here at your stand. And we love everything you do, and we're just glad you're here. So thanks a lot.
Thank you, Laura.
That was Nate Siemens, and he is the farmer and I guess the head pickler over there at Fat Uncle Farm. And he's brought in some pickled green almonds for everyone to enjoy. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
A recipe for Josiah Citron's halibut with smoked bacon and fava bean emulsion is on the Good Food blog. Also on the blog, you can listen to Laura Avery interview Mark McAfee about the latest on the Organic Pastures raw milk recall. As of this week, there's raw milk back at the market. It's that time on Good Food when Jonathan Gold joins us to tell us where to eat and what to order. He does this every week to explore every nook and cranny of Los Angeles. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and today we're headed to Connie's Seafood, which is the new name of Mariscos Chente in Inglewood.
Connie's Seafood, like Mariscos Chente, specializes in, I guess they call it like Sinaloa-Nayarit seafood cooking after, you know, two states on the west coast of Mexico. I think that probably most of the food there is less from that specific region than it is sort of some fantasy version of what people might eat in that region. And it can be broken down into two parts, or three parts, basically. One part is ceviches and cocktails, which is to say the raw stuff. One is the sort of Baroque shrimp dishes. And the third is what's probably their greatest dish at this point, which is pescados arrandeados.
Which is extraordinary.
It's an amazing dish.
Okay, so let's just describe that first and get it out of the way, and then let's go talk about the ceviches.
It's true, because you're going to want to get the pescados arrandeados. It's the most expensive thing on the menu. They sell it by the kilo, so if you see the $22, note that if you get a really big one, you're going to pay twice that maybe. In English, it translates as snook. It's a firm flesh fish. It's a little bit oily. It doesn't have an assertive flavor, but it has a definite sort of nutty overtones to it almost.
And it has just the texture. It has a wonderful texture the way Sergio cooks it.
Right. Cooking something zarandeado is a tedious process. There are almost certainly a dozen other places in L.A. doing fish zarandeado style. But it's difficult to do. I guess you cut it in half, like sort of, and
bookmark it.
And you flop it open from the spine. You put it in like a wire basket, and you cook it over hot coals.
It's slathered with a proprietary slather first,
right? Which is probably a lot of mayonnaise, probably a lot of, I'm guessing, Maggi seasoning. Something from your basic MSG family. There's probably chili involved. Anyway, this miraculous, like, miracle whip that may actually be a miracle. And in this basket, it's zarandeado means shaken. So it's basically moved back and forth like a pan of Jiffy Pop.
And it in good hands, it cooks really evenly. And it gets the perfect kind of char. What else comes on the plate with the fish?
It is served, by the way, not on a plate, but on a cafeteria tray, because it's the only vessel that's big enough to hold it. It's gigantic.
Yeah, it's gigantic.
It's thin, but it's very broad. And with that comes a couple of grilled chilies, a very, very nice, super spicy, fresh guacamole. Sometimes you have to ask for it. It doesn't automatically come, but they'll usually have it, and that's really good. And this bowl of onions that, like grilled onions, that taste as if they've been cooked down with, again, like Maggi or bouillon cube or something in the this is probably too intense to eat school. But some people think it's absolutely necessary. And you take it and you tear off pieces and put it in a tortilla with some of the condiments that you've had, and you eat it.
So let's move away from the zarandeado, and let's go to the raw part of the menu.
Mariscos Chente, from what I gather and from going to the place down in Lenox for years, basically specialized in cocktails, the raw fish things. And they do some very good ones. They used to, and I imagine still do, get shrimp directly from the Gulf, like a couple times a week. They have flavor that's not that sort of overcooked flavor, especially when it's ceviche, when it's not cooked at all. And they have a really pleasing texture. Probably the thing that almost everybody gets there is the aguachile. And the version here is, it's interesting. It's good. It's like a dozen or a dozen and a half shrimp arranged in a pinwheel around a large platter. And there's a lot of slices of cucumber. They cook it in lime juice or marinate it in lime juice to firm up the flesh. And they put a ton of this tart pureed jalapeno salsa over it. But I think if you're going in the raw shrimp direction, the one you might want to get instead is something they call ceviche marinero. The shrimp slightly chopped, tossed with like a chop of, you know, onions and cilantro and tomatoes and that sort of things. And served in this tart sauce that's probably flavored with Worcestershire, but is stronger and more pungent and a little bit sweet, but doesn't overpower.
So are there any cooked shrimp dishes that we should take a look at?
There's a big menu of them. There's probably 15. The ones that I would recommend are probably the camarones barachos, which are cooked with a little tequila and a lot of garlic. The camarones culichi, or the style of Culiacan, a part of Sinaloa, that have this sort of goopy sauce of jalapenos, cheese, and sour cream cooked together. So there's an effect of shrimp nachos in a way.
Yeah, I was going to say it sounds like queso.
You know you're not supposed to be eating it, but it's really, really good.
Absolutely worth the trip.
Definitely.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Glad to be here.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold of the LA Weekly about Connie's Seafood on West Imperial Highway in Inglewood. You can get the exact address and recommended dishes by simply texting the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. And don't forget that you can see all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions on the Good Food Restaurant Map, which is on the Good Food blog and Google Maps. No doubt the breaking story in this week's news was the death of Kim Jong-il. Hearing the news of his death brought back memories of conversations I've had here on the show about the food and lifestyle in North Korea.
Bobby Egan is the owner of a restaurant called Cubby's, which is a barbecue restaurant in Hackensack, New Jersey, on a rather grim industrial strip of a not particularly picturesque town. And he has become a kind of self-appointed liaison between North Korea and the North Korean representatives to the United Nations mission and the rest of us, America. He's an incredible raconteur. He has amazing stories where I could even check out, and they turned out to be true. And they're extraordinary. You know, you can't believe his story. He sort of became friendly with members of the very, very secretive North Korean mission to the United States and took these guys out on hunting trips and fishing trips and invited them over to his restaurant and became a sort of advisor to them on how to approach their place in the world.
Now, there was one story that you related in the article about how he was in North Korea and there was a cornfield and he saw these platforms that he looked at and he immediately thought that they were deer platforms and he asked why he had not been invited to go hunting.
And the people he were with turned around to him and said, what do you mean those aren't deer platforms? This is for when people try to sneak into the cornfields at night and try to steal the corn. This was just after they'd had a terrible famine there.
Wow.
What's amazing about Bobby Egan is he grew up in New Jersey, didn't go to college. He's a very ordinary kind of guy in many ways, and yet he's been to this part of the world that very few Americans have seen. He has seen things that most of us have not even had a chance to read about. But he got to know these people, and they got to know his family, and became quite a close personal relationship.
Does he use Cubby's, the restaurant, more as a meeting place for high-level officials he'd like to be close with, as a way to sort of break down barriers?
Yes, it's true. He does. I mean, I was there one day when some of the North Korean diplomats came in for lunch. And, you know, they sit there in the corner and have their steak and talk about the ways of the world. And, yeah, he does.
Now, I understand that there was a period during which he was the chef for the North Korean women's soccer team.
Yes, he served as the chef for the North Korean soccer team when they came to the Women's World Cup.
And he had sort of a wacky marketing idea.
He didn't manage to get any sponsorship for them, possibly because of the kind of ideas he was coming up with. One of them was that a sports drink company should sponsor them, and they could have an ad in which one of the players would kick the ball, and as she kicked it, it would turn into a nuclear explosion. Yeah, yeah. He's got a good sense of humor, this guy. What can I tell you?
So what does the U.S. government feel about him?
There's not a whole lot of acknowledgement of him. I was in touch with the office of Christopher Hill, and Ambassador Hill's office had not heard of him. There are some figures who have been quite high up in government who have dealt with him. But, you know, he's not on the White House invitation list, let's say.
You can hear more from this interview and other clips about food in North Korea on the Good Food blog. Stay tuned. I'll be back with more Good Food after this short break.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
For some cultures, a particular season or holiday has one dish, one cake, that's emblematic. For France, the Bûche de Noël is a sign that Yuletide is nigh. Gabriella Gershenson, senior editor of Savoir, explores the famed holiday cake. What does Bûche de Noël mean, Gabriella?
Bûche de Noël is the French term for the Yule log, or the Christmas log. And this is referring back to a tradition that is pre-Christian, that has ties to, the pagan holidays of celebrating the winter solstice by burning a huge, huge log and sort of bringing back symbolically the light and driving away the darkness. But then once Christianity sort of penetrated Europe, the log tradition, along with many other Christian Christmas traditions, was adopted for Christmas.
Could you describe for us what it looks like?
Yes. The Bûche de Noël is wonderful and whimsical because it's a trompe-l'œil, which is an optical illusion. It is a roulade or jelly roll cake that's made to look like a log that has fallen in the forest. So you'd have a roll and you'd have frosting, you know, and the traditional flavors might include coffee buttercream or praline or chestnut or chocolate. And the frosting is scored with a fork so that it looks sort of like tree bark. And sometimes you might have like a little slice of the jelly roll taken off and poised on that log so that it looks like a little stump. And the traditional decorations also are references to the forest. So you'd have meringue mushrooms or little sprigs of marzipan holly, maybe some crushed nuts that resemble moss. So it's very much like a theme dessert.
It's like a little mise-en-scene.
It is, and it's wonderful because it seems that, especially now, with the directions that pastry chefs in France are taking this dessert, the more whimsical and the more imaginative, the better.
It's interesting to me because so much of the culture of French pastry is still quite classic and unchanging except for the flavors. And it seems maybe the craziness of flavors from macarons have maybe infected the Yule log.
Well, there's a really interesting book that I'd love to mention by a writer named Michael Crandall. And it just came out. It's called Sweet Invention. And he does a wonderful job of chronicling the history of sweets in different cultures. And what I discovered from referencing his book and researching for the story is that the whole notion of whimsy and invention and creativity is very much a part of the French pastry tradition. It's a tradition that grew out of the bourgeois life of France in the 19th century, that grew out of the need of pastry chefs who were competing with each other in Paris to attract the patronage of bourgeois people. So the more creative among the pastry chefs, the more they would be rewarded for their creativity with customers.
So give me an idea of what kind of bouche de Noël you're seeing in the best pastry shops. What are some of the flavors that you're seeing that you find so interesting and unusual?
Well, it was very surprising. I'll talk flavors and I'll also talk forms, because the bouche de Noël has evolved past the log form. I mean, among the top pastry chefs in France right now, the log is very old-fashioned. But first, to touch upon flavors, one flavor that really seems ubiquitous among the high-end pastry shops in France is yuzu, which is the Asian citrus. And it's just very commonplace now. And other flavors that I'm seeing are, you know, wonderful tart light combinations like pistachio with sour cherry. Pierre Hermé does a dessert that has lychee and rose that he has sort of adapted for the bouche de Noël. The sky is really the limit. And as far as what they look like now, I had the privilege of going to the famous tea salon called Angelina on the Rue de Rivoli. And they have a very lovely young pastry chef there named Sebastian Bauer, who spent years working with legendary pastry chef Pierre Hermé. And he made a special mold. He designed a mold that looked like a row of macarons. So to speak to your point about macaron sort of being a microcosm of this burst of creativity in French pastry, he made his bouche de Noël look like a row of cookies by creating a mold where he poured chocolate, and then he filled that mold with creme brulee and raspberry puree and chocolate biscuit, which is cake, and also just a wonderful Peruvian chocolate mousse that he made. It was very complex. Now pastry chefs are unveiling their designs for bouche de Noël every fall to the press. So it's become sort of like a fashion show. It's a way for pastry chefs to unveil their flavors for the season and their designs for the season. And it's competitive and it's showy. It's very much an opportunity for creativity and spectacle, much the way that fashion is. And the fact that some of these are shaped like staircases and some of them like purses and some of them are bright yellow and the flavor of yuzu, it doesn't change the fact that they are all still considered bouche de Noël.
Well, Gabriella, this has been such a lovely conversation. Thank you very much for sharing Savoir's take on bouche de Noël with us.
Thank you for having me.
Gabriella Gershenson is the senior editor of Savoir magazine. An outtake of our conversation, including tips for making bouche de Noël at home, is on the Good Food blog, along with a link to her original article in Savoir.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose.
Those lyrics usher in the holiday season every year, but how many of us actually spend the holidays roasting chestnuts over an open fire? Most of the chestnuts that we find on supermarket shelves are very disappointing, and the American variety has been under threat for years. Sarah Fitzsimmons is the Regional Science Coordinator Supervisor for the American Chestnut Foundation. She joins us here this morning to discuss her quest for an imperishable tree.
In many parts of the temperate forested areas, Italy included, much of the Alpine region, China, Japan, and America, the chestnut tree has been a real cultural and gastronomic fixture. In America, however, we've had a real problem with our chestnut because we had an imported fungus that got imported from China and Japan. This fungus was brought over actually on Japanese chestnuts that were brought over in the mid-1800s. This is primarily why plant quarantine laws were introduced, was because of this fungus that they brought over. And In 1904, the fungus was actually identified in the Bronx Zoo. By 1905, the entire original range of the American chestnut was affected by this fungal disease.
We know that there are so many fungal problems with vegetables that we see all the time, like tomatoes. And there's always all this hybridization that's being worked on by agricultural scientists to try and create new varieties that are resistant. Has that been happening with the chestnut?
Well, essentially that's what we're trying to do. We're taking really classic breeding methods that the crop breeders have used in corn, soybeans, tomatoes, like you mentioned, and trying to take a trait like blight resistance from resistant trees like Chinese chestnuts, Japanese chestnuts. We're trying to take that resistant trait and put it into the American chestnut. And using classical breeding techniques, which is basically like taking the flowers of the trees, putting them together, making seeds, planting them, growing them up, testing them, you know, putting the parents together, making the seeds, planting them, growing them up, so on and so forth. We do that six times, a minimum of six generations. Each of those generations takes between 5 and 10 years to complete. So you can see that this is a pretty long-term project, taking between 35 to 60 years just to get through to test the original hypothesis that this thing will even work. We've gotten to a point where we have six-generation material, stuff that we think is highly blight-resistant and highly American in character. And since 2008, we've been putting those out in the forest in large testing populations.
During the course of this pilot project, have you had the opportunity to taste chestnuts from these American trees?
Oh, sure thing. And you know, even though the American chestnut in our forests harbor this disease and constantly get killed back by it, you can still find a lot of American chestnuts in the forests of the Appalachians that are producing nuts. That's what we use in our breeding program. So if you're lucky enough to find an American chestnut in the woods that's fruiting, they're very tasty. They're very sweet. They're small. They're the smallest true chestnut, but they're definitely worth the effort of taking the time to peel them and open them up because they're very tasty.
So take me through the main types of chestnut and teach us about the different sort of flavor profiles and texture of like the European, the Italian variety, the Chinese, the Japanese, and the American.
There are seven chestnut species out there within the genus Castanea, but only four of which are really used for eating. The other three are too small. You really wouldn't fool with those. So the American chestnut's the smallest, but it's also probably the sweetest. The Chinese chestnut is the next smallest, but it's also very sweet. And in my opinion, one of the best ones for both size and sweetness and character. The European is the next largest. I tend to find, especially the ones that are imported, to be pretty mealy. And the Japanese as well, they're even larger than the European. And both the Japanese and the European tend to be grown for size. And typically, those are candied somehow. So they're usually a vehicle for some other kind of sauce or sweet thing or pureed into soups and things, whereas the Chinese and Americans are better eaten fresh or roasted, freshly roasted or used whole in stuffing and things like that.
Describe how the chestnuts look on the tree and what you have to do to get to what we consider to be the nut.
The chestnuts, there are typically three chestnuts inside a very spiny hull called a burr. And when they first start growing from the female flower, they look like green spiny sea urchins. And then they grow and they grow until they get to be the size of a baseball or a softball and they start to turn brown. They still look like sea urchins. They look even more like sea urchins when they start to mature. And then about September, October, those burrs start to split open and show the three nuts that are inside. To get to them, you have to do a couple of things. You have to beat off all the other critters and varmints that want those chestnuts too. And you've got to have a really good pair of gloves to open up those really spiny burrs to get into the chestnuts that are inside.
Now, anyone who has roasted chestnuts at home for making, let's say, chestnut stuffing has discovered that the chestnut can be a very obstinate nut. What is your best practice for roasting and peeling a chestnut?
It really depends on what you're going to use it for. If you're going to use it in a soup or a stuffing, I find the easiest way to do it, and I learned this from a grower up in Wisconsin. He actually has a really cool YouTube video on YouTube, is if you take a good pair of shears and you cut it in half and you dip that in boiling water, That'll take the nut meat right out. So if you're going to use that in stuffings or, you know, with kale and bacon, which is one of my favorite preparations of chestnuts, that's the easiest way to get them out. If you're going to eat them fresh, you score them in the back with a knife, or I just bite them in half and eat them that way. If you're going to roast them, the best way is to score them with a knife, or there actually is a tool out there. It's a chestnut marker, which makes an X in the back of the chestnut, and then you put that in the microwave or your chestnut roaster on an open fire for a few minutes, and you have to score it so that it doesn't explode, basically.
Thank you so much. This has been so informative.
Sure. My pleasure.
Sarah Fitzsimmons is the Regional Science Coordinator Supervisor for the American Chestnut Foundation. We've been talking about chestnuts. Did you know that you can actually eat them raw? Here's Sarah's tips for how to enjoy the raw nuts in an outtake from our conversation on the Good Food blog. Coming up, I've got tips for what to eat on New Year's Eve, whether you're staying in or going out. That's in 1 minute here on 89.9 and KCRW.com.
This is producer Jillian Ferguson. You can connect with other food lovers on Evan's Facebook page, share photos, ask questions, and meet new friends. Search for Evan Kleinman on Facebook and click like.
You're listening to Good Food here on KCRW. 1 week from today marks the grand finale to the holiday season, New Year's Eve. Here today to discuss the event are Leslie Barger-Suter, dine editor for Los Angeles Magazine, and Leslie Bala, contributor to Angeleno Magazine and author of ChowBala.com. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, so it's New Year's Eve. We're making plans. Some of us are planning on going out and having a very celebratory time. Some of us are planning on staying in and having a celebratory time. Let's start with going out. Suter, I understand that that is your bailiwick for the purposes of this conversation.
For the purposes of this conversation, I completely understand the impulse to stay in, but there is something fun about going out for a meal on New Year's Eve. People think it can be overpriced. It can be. People can think that it's too crowded. It can be, but not at some of LA's fabulous places. My idea is every place should have a theme. Your night should have a theme. It should be fun. It should not just be about food that is far too expensive. Let's start, let's just blow it out with really high-end everything to start. The Bazaar. Jose Andres, a Spanish place at the SLS Hotel in Beverly Hills. When you walk in, Philippe Stark designed it. It looks already like some sort of crazy carnival. Well, tonight, for a mere $250, it is Spanish masquerade. So it is going to be as whimsical as you would expect Jose's New Year's Eve to be.
Are you expected to come in masquerade attire?
I think it's encouraged. I think you could wear a lovely festive mask without committing too much. But there's going to be roving carts that are going around making their liquid nitrogen caipirinhas. Leslie, have you had one of those?
Yes. And hopefully they'll probably make the salt air margaritas, and they have, you know, these big legs of jamon in the middle of the room and somebody just slicing it right there.
It's indulgent and beautiful, but I think that's sort of how you want it to be. And I love the fact that it's sort of roving carts. It makes the whole, you're not just sitting at a table by yourself. It's very mobile. There's going to be a Spanish guitarist. And then after the dinner is over, things move to their little adjacent party room that's going to have cocktails and a countdown. But you're paying for a big night, but it should be a pretty big night. So that's good.
Yeah, I think that's probably good value for dollars.
Yes, I think it will. Speaking of value for dollar, though, let's go to the other end, but also still on the fine dining side of things. Il Covo, which is Sean McPherson, he's sort of known for his hip, clubby places. Well, this is his sort of first attempt at doing something kind of grown up. It's Italian. It's where Orso used to be, so it's got that great courtyard. If they have heaters out there, it'll be nice. But they're doing actually a pretty great deal for what I think is some pretty indulgent food. $65 for the entire tasting menu that includes stuff like lobster with sea urchin and porcini mushrooms. There's scallop ravioli with caviar. They have cotechino, which is the traditional New Year's Eve sort of Italian salumi with it. They're serving with lentils, which is traditional. And then a pistachio semifreddo for dessert. You get a champagne toast and all of that, all for $65 per
That's
person.
That's pretty great.
And if you want to do wine pairings with each course, which they're offering, it's an only additional $40. So that's pretty good. While we are speaking, though, of hip young people that like to do fun, fabulous things. Mohawk Bend and Tony's Darts Away. They're two sort of beer-centric places. Mohawk Bend is new. It's in Echo Park. It's sort of an old movie theater. Tony's Darts Away is in Burbank. It's a really great, cool gastropub. And they both of these are doing beer-centric New Year's Eve events. At Tony's, for $95, which sounds like a lot because it's beer, but it's all you can eat or drink at Tony's Darts Away. And Tony's specializes in sausages. They do sort of sausage and great Belgian fries, and they have a lot of vegan options and vegetarian options in these sausages.
And what I love about Tony's, I've been going there recently a lot. I have a friend who lives nearby. It's so laid back. It's such a great, they have all these games there. They have trivia games and board games. They have darts and they have a pool table. It's just such a great place and just a great crowd.
Now, Bala, if we want to stay in, wow, there is so much choice.
I mean, what I suggest not doing is just relying on the good old Trader Joe's and Whole Foods and Ralph's. Definitely, if you want to step it up, there are so many options. So, you know, there are some of the best wine stores in town. Just because it's a wine store does not mean that they have expensive bottles of wine. So I'm a big fan of Silver Lake Wine. I always have been. You go in there and you, anybody in that store, and say, I am looking for something in the $10 to $15 range. I want something reasonably priced and I want it red. I want some white. It's like, boom, they have it for you. And almost always, I trust their palate so much. Me personally, I've never had a bad bottle of wine there. It's just incredible.
And on the west side, there's the Wine House.
Exactly.
And on Melrose, there's Domaine LA.
Exactly. And in Pasadena, there's a new store called Monopole, which I've just discovered. It's right next to the Playhouse. And it is one of the best stores that I've come across, especially in Pasadena. And I found a great Barbera there for, I think, $13.99. I cannot remember the name of it right now. But that's been my go-to house wine for a couple of months now. And it's so much better than, you know, a really bad bottle of wine that you can't really trust, but it's cheap, that you're buying off of a shelf at a grocery store.
And I think the key to all of these places is you can really take the stress out of that whole choice of wine by just putting yourself in the hands of somebody who's not going to steer you wrong. They want you to come back.
Right. Leslie, you were saying that the Wine House has a really large champagne selection.
Yeah, the Wine House has won. We do our Best Of Awards every year at the magazine, and they've won several times for best champagne selection, and they are not kidding. We've done the research. It is true. They have the largest bubbly selection in all of Los Angeles. So if you like making that choice and you like getting to do a little of your own hand picking, you could find pretty much anything you can think of.
And then stick with Cava and Prosecco if you don't want to spend a lot of money. You don't have to buy fancy French champagne to celebrate. Speaking of sparkling things, another great option is beer. So we talked about beer, these beer-focused New Year's Eve nights out. Coming in, there is a great new beer shop in Echo Park called Sunset Beer Company. They have an amazing selection of beers, all these great Belgian ales, a lot of seasonal ales, a lot from California, all over California. One of the best beer selections retail-wise that I have seen, I think, in the city, and it's growing. And then you could also, for a party, another really great idea is to get one of the growlers filled at one of the breweries. Golden Road is a good example.
Eagle Rock Brewery does it, I think Craftsman, too, if you ask him nicely.
Yeah, you know, they're 64-ounce refillable jugs. You buy the jug, you drink it, you take it back, you get it refilled. It's such a great party idea. It's like between bottles and a keg. You don't have to invest in it. It's something super big.
Okay, so now we have our ability to make ourselves in a really festive mood down. So now we need something to blot all that up.
Yeah, let's talk about how to get some food in there so that you're not ripped too early, basically. So cheese stores, you know, of course, Andrew's in Santa Monica. We have Beverly Hills Cheese Store. We have the Cheese Store of Pasadena. We have Silver Lake Cheese Store.
And Artisan Cheese.
In the Valley, right? And these are great places. And this, again, is so much easier, better to have somebody who knows the product, you know, have a blue, have a hard cheese, have a semi, you know, a soft cheese, get a sheep's milk, get a cow's milk, get a goat's milk. And you go in and you talk to somebody for a few minutes and they'll steer you in the right direction. They'll tell you how much to get for how many people. They know everything. Another great idea is, you know, a lot of people think when they're drinking sparkling wine or champagne that oysters and, you know, getting a raw bar together is really difficult, but it's really not. It's sort of the same philosophy is going to a cheese store. Go to one of the fish markets and say, you know, we want to do a fancy raw bar at our house. what do we need? You know, you want oysters and clams and maybe some crab claws or something. And again, they will pick out what you want, the kind of seafood you should get. They'll even help give you tips on how to store it. They will tell you how to shuck an oyster. They will give you, they'll show you how to do it. You can buy the tools there to do it. It's really easy to actually put that stuff together.
In the eastern part of Los Angeles, Fish King.
Exactly.
Western part of Los Angeles, Santa Monica Seafood.
Exactly. And then even in the South Bay, I've actually had some luck getting crabs and shellfish down at Quality Seafood on the Redondo Pier.
One little tip, most of your better seafood markets will give you a bucket of that ice that they pack stuff on to take home. If you ask them, they'll put it in a bag, which is great for your own sort of display purposes for this raw bar, because your little refrigerator ice machine may not be able to handle that much ice. So you can always ask them, and a lot of times they'll give it to you.
And then one little tip that I've discovered before but just recently revisited, if you don't want to shuck oysters and you really want oysters, really simple, throw them on the grill. They practically pop open themselves. All you need is a butter knife and a really good industrial work glove to maybe pick them up off the grill, or a really thick towel. But it's so simple. You pop them on the grill for a few minutes, flip them over, take a butter knife, just stick it in, pop it up, and put a little tiny bit of butter on it, and it's pure deliciousness. It is so, so good. So, and then, you know, of course, the other thing that you can do is get the whole spread. You can go to a restaurant and go to the Larder at Tavern in Brentwood, go to Clementine, Jones on 3rd, the marketplace at Santa Monica Place with all those great little markets. There's a wine store there, Vinocado, which is another great wine store to throw into the mix. You know, another idea just to make every party really festive is to have some kind of fun party favor. And I recently discovered this lovely woman, Kimberly Berg, who has a company called Psychic Fortunes. This is the best party favor ever. I took them for Thanksgiving, and it's amazing. She's a psychic, and she does personalized individual readings for every one of your guests. You give her a guest list, and she will just first names even. That's all she needs. And she will write a small fortune, psychic fortune, personalized for that person, stick it in a fortune cookie, packages it up. Each package has that person's name on it. It is a total winner for dinner parties.
It's eerie, and they're very fun, and everybody likes a little psychic. You have to see what your new year holds in store for you.
We mentioned Tavern now as a source for eating at home, but just to end our lovely time together, Tavern must be having something happening on New Year's Eve.
They are doing, for the New Year's Eve seating, it's $100. They are doing a Mad Men-themed New Year's, which is kind
fun.
Of in L.A. how you want to do New Year's, you know, like a martini. They have an artisanal martini cart that's going to be going around. They've got an oyster bar. They're doing Suzanne Goyen, the chef, is doing a 50s and 60s era classic dishes. So it's going to be kind of retro. It's a tavern. It's going to be so swanky. But I think that's kind of an ultimate dining out New Year's Eve option.
Well, Leslie's, this has been such a fun thing, and I hope we get to do it again.
Thank you.
So do we.
I've been talking to Leslie Barger-Suter of Los Angeles Magazine and Leslie Bala of ChowBala.com and Angeleno Magazine. We've been talking about what to do this New Year's Eve. You can find all of their suggestions on our website. Now that we know what to do on New Year's Eve, let's talk about New Year's Day. Cultures all over the world celebrate New Year's Day with a meal that promises to bring luck and prosperity. Suckling pig can be found on New Year's tables in Cuba, Portugal, Austria, and Hungary. And in Italy, lentils are on the table. But the American South has its own unique tradition. Stephen Strajewski, chef and co-owner of Cochon in New Orleans, tells us more. It's so great to have you with us.
Ah, hello. It's nice to be here.
So I guess let's focus on Hoppin' John. What are its origins?
My understanding of the origins of Hoppin' John are to be the African slave influence in conjunction with rice, the field peas that came from Africa, black-eyed peas, which are a sign of prosperity, are mixed with rice and then a good bit of some kind of salt pork and served as a main dish.
Could you take us through the preparation? Is it sort of like a pilaf?
Usually, you'll cook it more like a stew, creating a base with the ham and fortify the broth with some kind of smoked meat product, usually bacon or ham. I like to put ham hocks in there. then you'll create a really deep flavored broth and then cook the rice in there, and it'll come out with the consistency, not a brothy consistency, like a thick, more like a paella.
Do you use that same kind of rice as you would in paella?
No, I use a southern rice, a long grain Louisiana rice.
And what about the black-eyed peas? Why do they have this tradition of being a good luck charm?
I think it has something to do with the, you know, they're super prevalent. They grow in the summertime, but they last forever. Most of the long storage items in the South aren't the same as they are in the northern United States. Like cabbages grow in the wintertime here, but they don't store very well. Potatoes don't grow very well down here because of the humid climate and the heat. But things like black-eyed peas, you grow in the summertime and you can keep them for the whole year.
Does it normally show up on a dinner table, a breakfast table, all day long? Is it New Year's Eve or in the morning, the next morning, New Year's Day?
It's New Year's Day. You know, New Year's Eve, you go out and you revel and have a great time and then sleep a little later on New Year's Day and then set up a whole buffet and have people come by and toast to the New Year and enjoy a big buffet. Greens and Hoppin' John. The greens are supposed to represent the money, and the Hoppin' John, the coins, and prosperity.
I wonder if it's just because when you put your hands through a bag of them, there are just so many sort of running through your hands, a lot like coins do.
That's a great idea.
Are there a lot of different regional variations on the making of the dish?
Yes, there are. Traditionally in Louisiana, they don't actually call it Hoppin' John. There's not a, you know, it's beans and rice. But where I learned to make it in North Carolina, I worked with lots of people that were from the Low Country. And that's where they call it Hoppin' John. You know, the name has kind of carried over to Louisiana. Hoppin' John is much sexier than beans and rice. But yeah, you know, it's the exact same dish. As much as any two dishes are the same in the South, as many people as there are in the South, there are that many versions of any dish. But it is a traditional New Year's Day item.
Do you find the sofrito triumvirate that seems to be in so many Louisiana-based dishes in Hoppin' John?
Yes, and usually use a little bit of a spicier pepper, whether... you know, a small amount of jalapeno or a large amount of a poblano or in conjunction with sweet bell peppers.
So you have the onion, the pepper.
And celery.
And celery. I love how much you guys use celery. It's like such an underappreciated vegetable.
I agree. I think it's ready for a renaissance.
So the greens that represent the money, what type of greens do you usually end up using?
Usually by New Year's, it's cabbage. I enjoy mustard greens the best, but collards and mustards kind of peter out there at that time of year just because of the cold.
Now, you're a man who is truly in love with and honors the pig in a very profound way. Do you tend to make any of these dishes vegetarian-based, or in your mind is cooking greens or cooking a Hoppin' John without the addition of the pork element just kind of heresy?
I'd rather cook them in a different manner. You know, if I'm going to do greens with, like, mustard greens without bacon, I usually like them, like, sautéed quickly, like tender, younger greens sautéed quickly with just some onions and garlic and a little bit of water. I usually use chicken stock in the restaurant just because it's conveniently there, but I think it's a perfect application for water, and finish it with just a touch of butter.
And what about these New Year's rice and beans? How would you make the preparation different if you had to extract the pork?
I would probably go so far as to do something like smoke some tomatoes. I mean, because I think an important aspect of it is that smoky flavor. And if I were going to do it as a vegetarian dish, it's traditionally a side dish, but if I was going to do it as something for vegetarians, I would probably do some kind of cook the sofrito down and then add some smoked tomato, or even better, I would probably just cook it without the pork product and then lightly smoke some tomatoes and then do like a vinaigrette and serve the tomatoes as a salad on top and then have it as a main dish instead of a side item.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
That was Steven Strajewski, chef and owner of Cochon Restaurant in New Orleans and Lafayette. A recipe for Steven's Hoppin' John is on the Good Food blog. How do you plan to usher in the new year? Share your ideas on my Facebook page. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. The holidays, more than any other time of year, are all about baking. And for many of us, that means cookies. Sasha Woodruff is an independent producer who recalls her childhood growing up in a house where the phrase Christmas cookies meant more than just a dozen bell-shaped sugar cookies.
When we were children, here's how my sister and I would see and smell the arrival of the Christmas season. Pounds of butter, nuts, flour, sugar, and jam piled up on the kitchen counters. A seasonal drapery of steam would remain on the windows from Thanksgiving to Christmas. The oven was always on.
I made medvedye tlapichki, honey cookies.
The holiday cookie production in the Woodruff household was epic. Little butter creations that looked like cat eyes, crescent moons, horseshoes would start filling tins stacked on the counters.
Okay, 300 grams of all-purpose unbleached flour. So 300 grams of flour, one vanillin sugar. Then we come with 200 grams of butter, 100 grams of powdered sugar. So as we could tell, they are not going to be very sweet.
Sounds of eggs cracking, nuts grinding, and butter being cut into flour join the smells of vanilla, powdered sugar, chocolate, and hazelnuts. Some were baked spread out into shallow baking trays, others in tiny metal tins. Some were dipped in chocolate, others rolled in egg whites and nuts. We decorated spice and honey cookies with a lemon frosting tinted with food coloring.
Okay, now I have two little balls of the dough. I knead it together so it's nice and smooth. Then I round it up, flour the board. This is a really labor of love. We used to make these till 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, and we would make a trays with 10, 12 different kind of cookies and take it over to the neighbors as a present for Christmas.
My mom is from Slovakia, formerly part of Czechoslovakia in Eastern Europe, and baking confections around Christmas in that part of the world is a tradition that goes back hundreds of years.
I think it all came from Austria when we were part of Austro-Hungarian monarchy. And our friends from Vienna said that it usually came from the Turks who used to make these delicious fine cookies for the coffee.
Back in the old country when my mom was growing up in the mid-1940s, she and her family would make everything from scratch. There was no other option than local. The butter was delivered from a nearby dairy, the eggs were from backyard chickens, and the jams were made from berries picked from the garden.
People used to spend days and nights canning the fruit in summer, then using it during the winter. So it was one way it was nice, and the other way it was a lot of work.
And processing the nuts could take days.
We had a nut tree, big, huge nut tree in the garden, and we would pick the nuts. And then 2-3 weeks before Christmas, we would hit them with a hammer, put them on a tray, and then friends came over in the evenings, and we would be sitting around a table and shelling the nuts. And it is such a sweet memories because we always talked and told stories, and it was really nice.
We have a lot of family history folded into baking and cooking. My great-grandmother was legendary in the kitchen and ran a restaurant at a nearby spa. My grandmother left Czechoslovakia when the communists took power in 1948 and eventually ended up here in Los Angeles.
My mother never had recipes. She just took flour, sugar, and mixed it together, and that was it.
Then my mom moved here 20 years later. When she married my father and moved from Los Angeles to Salt Lake City, Utah, she set out to make her own cookies without her mother's or grandmother's help.
Every 5 minutes, I would call my mother for the recipes. However, she never had the recipe, so she always said, well, you know, just do this, this, this. And I would do it. And then I would call on the phone 5 minutes later and I go, like, they are too fragile. She says, okay, then you have too much flour in it. Add more butter. So then I would add more butter. Then they were falling apart and I would call again.
Eventually, she figured out the recipes, what kind of butter and flour to buy in her new home, and she started adding more varieties to the collection, including one made with pork fat that my mom failed to tell my vegetarian sister what the key ingredient was.
She tasted those cookies and she said those are the best cookies I had ever eaten. So we didn't tell her that they had a lard in it, and then she says she knows and she really still liked them.
And of course, this was not the only controversy that erupted. Baking that many cookies in a relatively small kitchen was overwhelming for my mom, with two distracted daughters and a husband with a tendency for sampling more than his fair share of the raw cookie dough. My mom admits the recipes are so time-consuming, she understands why people would not want to make them.
I, you know, always got really stressed because we would make a lot of cookies and there was always a shopping, and then you always forgot to have enough eggs or enough flour, and we had to run to the store and get more. I tried to do everything perfectly, and it usually worked. Ooh, burning cookies. Okay, watch out, Tashi. Get away. Where's the cooling rack? Here, Matsi, can you... Here.
I got one right here.
No, Matsi, you don't. It's here.
But what would the holidays be without stress? In the end, when we finished Christmas Eve dinner with a plate of those cookies, all the tense moments seemed worth it with that first buttery bite.
And we are done.
For Good Food, I'm Sasha Woodruff.
A recipe for Sasha's mother's Christmas cookies is on the Good Food blog. If you missed any part of today's show, just download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also find Good Food on demand, the easiest way, on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Good Food is produced by Jillian Ferguson. Laro Garcia and Candace Moyer are our segment producers, and the executive producer is Harriet Ells. Thanks to Ronnie Mickelson and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.